Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. There's been a lot of scrutiny on the health of school cafeteria meals in recent decades, but little to no attention has been paid to the quality of our children's brown bag lunches. Well, researchers recently took a peek inside those bags to find out what the average parent is packing, and the truth isn't exactly appetizing. Boston Globe features writer Beth Tytel wrote about the study and the struggle that parents face when preparing school lunches at home, and she joins us now to put it all on the table. Beth, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so first of all, I guess we should establish, do you know how many kids bring a lunch from home rather than get one at the school cafeteria?
Well, that's kind of interesting. It turns out that more than 40% of kids bring a lunch.
Wow.
I don't know what statistic on how many kids actually eat those lunches, but yeah, that's actually part of the reason these researchers at Tufts decided to look into it. I mean, as you said, there has been such intense focus on what the school, what the lunch lady is serving. In fact, you know, such a everybody will remember or has heard that the Reagan administration famously characterized ketchup as a vegetable.
Right.
And more recently, our own Congress has pizza counts as a vegetable because of the tomato sauce. But the Tufts people decided to look into what the parents were packing.
Okay, so what did they find then? What did the researchers find when they looked inside those brown paper bags?
Well, actually, it was kind of, I guess to them, it was sort of surprising because what they found was that none of the lunches, so they studied lunches at 12 schools, undisclosed schools in the eastern part of Massachusetts, and they discovered that none of the lunches met all five of the National School Lunch Program standards. And those standards emphasize fruits and vegetables and whole grains, low or non-fat dairy. So none of them met all five of those standards, but only 27% of them lunches met at least three of the goals. So they had things in, they said that there was a lot of sugary drinks, like sweetened teas, packaged foods. Apparently there were a lot of, what was it, what did the woman tell me? Oh, a lot of gummy fruit snacks were common, she said. Potato chips, cookies.
Yeah, and that's what kind of kills me is that, you know, I understand that, you know, a parent would want to create a lunch that's, you know, sort of diverse. It's got a little bit of the healthy stuff and maybe a snack, a cookie or something like that. But they also discovered a lot of lunches had only bad snacks. There was literally no entree.
That's right. They said almost one in four lacked an entree, such as a sandwich or leftovers. And instead, they were made up, as you were saying, entirely of packaged snacks and desserts. You know what I find kind of interesting? I have kids myself, so this was actually very, very familiar to me, that it's almost like there's this game of lunch brinksmanship that goes on. Who's going to blink first? Because you have the parents who, most parents want their kids to eat healthy food. But the problem is they're afraid that they're not going to eat anything if they only put the healthy food in it. And since they're not standing over them insisting that they do have the carrots or the turkey or whatever they want the kids to eat, they send something else just in case so the child isn't hungry, you know, 9 hours after they return after doing some sports or whatever. But then the kids say they don't have time to eat the healthy food. Somehow it's more time-consuming and only have time for the desserts.
So you think that's probably more of a factor than, say, parents who are rushing in the morning and just don't have time to pack a healthy lunch?
You know, I think, well, I interviewed a sociologist who wrote a book with a great title. It's called It's Not About the Broccoli. And I think the rushing, and she was talking about all the factors that play into it. And what she said was that there was a bunch of things. She said that the goal of nutrition, one, but that's not the only one. She said they don't want their kids to be hungry or they don't want to have a conflict with their kids or they want them to be happy or they've got 12 other kids and other things going on. So I find as a parent, it's not really that packing something healthy takes longer. I think there should be a new unit of time that gets into the psychology of time. It's almost more stressful to be packing something that you know might not be eaten and that might be perishable, so it's going to actually come back. You're putting it in the strawberries, let's say. Then they spend the whole day. They're never eaten. They come back wilted. So even though it might not take longer to wash the strawberries and put them in the Tupperware and give them to your child, it feels like it's longer than putting in some pretzels because the pretzels kind of have a happy, not that you don't want the kids to eat them, but they have almost a happy association since that's going to be success in some way since the child will eat it.
Like you're going to bring your kids joy, but if you give them veggies, it's just a waste.
Right, but yeah, exactly. And this one thing that she said was very interesting. So this is the woman, the author of that book called It's Not About the Broccoli. Her name is Dinah Rose. She said that parents make the at least compromise. That's what she called it. She said at least chocolate milk has calcium. At least chicken nuggets have protein. But she said if you think of the cumulative effect of the at least mindset, we're actually teaching our kids the exact opposite habits we want them to have. So she said we're dumbing down their diets and we're pushing their taste buds towards junk and away from healthy food. So sort of like you're doing yourself in day by day by day, but each day you're kind of short. Not every parent, of course, but many are short-sighted. Or, you know, this is something I didn't even get into in the article, but it struck me later that, of course, as adults, most people don't have great diets. And some people, in fact, don't even really know what the ideal diet is. It can be confusing. So some parents, I have a feeling, actually don't even know that what they're sending isn't good. Maybe they are actually kind of pleased about it.
Right. We might be just as guilty as that at least mindset as the kids are. So it seems to me, you know, you describe this tug of war, sort of this damned if you do, damned if you don't. You give them vegetables, they don't eat it. You don't give it to them, they don't necessarily get the healthy, well-rounded meal. Well, you even note in your article that there are fewer kids buying these healthier school lunches since those national standards were changed to require more fruits and veggies and less salt and sugar.
You know, that was interesting. That was a study done. You're right. That was a study done by the General Accounting Office in 2012. Yes, in fact, that study found that I think it was a million kids fewer were buying lunches. So that was actually kind of bad for business for the people serving lunches because it was cutting down on business for them. But more recently, a study was done, a smaller study, that found that, in fact, despite initial resistance, more kids actually were accepting these healthy lunches. So it you know, it does make sense in some ways that kids get used to something. Or they, you know, they get hungry.
They'll adjust. If they have to adjust, they're going to eat.
They will adjust. And also the thing is, you know, I do think that sociologist made a good point because if fruit, for example, most children can actually find some fruit that they like. I mean, fruit can be just absolutely terrific. So I think it's both things, the parents kind of almost dooming themselves by thinking, oh, she won't eat fruit, when in fact maybe the kid would if that was all they, that was what they were given.
So any recommendations for the struggling parent? You know, I mean, maybe that recommendation is stop bringing it from home and buy the school lunch.
You know, I was thinking the same thing. That's kind of interesting. The only problem, I think, is that, right, but you then have to make sure your kid's actually eating the healthy thing at the lunch. Like, they could buy the full lunch that has the salad and the fruit, but then not eat the salad and the fruit. I don't think anyone's looked into it at that level. But the one recommendation I did hear that I thought was good was to if you're making lunch, involve your kids in the lunch decisions. So say, tell me some things you think you'd like to eat. And then you come up with it together. So, and you know, it's a mix. And that way maybe the kid would say, well, I don't want turkey, but I actually really do like hummus. Or so you can maybe hit on something that would be acceptable to the child and also healthy.
Well, Beth Tytel, thank you so much for speaking with us today. Appreciate it.
Oh, thanks a lot. It's a fun topic.
Beth Tytel is features writer for the Boston Globe. After the interview, Beth and I talked about our memories of the brown bag lunches we packed, or perhaps I should say were packed for us, back in the day.
I grew up, we lived in New York City. When I was 13, we moved from New York to a sort of a waspy town in Connecticut. And my mother made me these really thick roast beef sandwiches. And none of my friends had ever seen a sandwich that thick. Their sandwiches were just this one slice of meat, white bread.
Like, I also remember what I ate for years because I did peanut butter and fluff sandwiches for something like 3 or 4 years in a row every single day.
That's really interesting that as an adult you have a clear memory often of what you had for school lunch, and yours sounds delicious.
Our conversation about what kids get in their lunches these days also brought back vivid memories for the Word of Mouth team. So we asked a few people at the station if they remembered the lunches of their youth.
I had the same lunch probably almost every day in 5th, 6th, maybe even 7th grade. My mom packed for me pepperoni as kind of a lunch cold cut. I don't know if that's even a thing still now or ever. And always a can of seltzer. I really liked seltzer water for a while.
Nothing exotic. I mean, peanut butter sandwich, glass of milk. Sort of thing, but I always lived near school, so I would, when it was time for lunch, I would just walk home. And largely that was due to an aversion to the stench of the cafeteria.
I would always have a sandwich, either turkey or ham, and usually an apple or a tomato. And then, you know, those little Dove chocolates? I would have 2 to 3 every day.
I remember, it was always a brown bag lunch, always sort of a mushy sandwich in like a little sandwich baggie. And we didn't even get the Ziploc baggies. We had like the fold-over baggies, and I just hated those.
There was a branded version of Hi-C, I think it was, Ecto Cooler. And my mom, being a creative genius, she would freeze my Ecto Cooler, and she would give me a spoon. And so at lunchtime, I would not only have a nice, cool lunch, but I would have an Ecto Cooler slushie every day. It was the best. Thanks, Mom.
And we want to know what you're packing your kids for school. Do you struggle with the balance between healthy food and food they'll actually eat without being coerced? Snap a picture of your kid's brown bag lunch and share your school lunch strategy with us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio, and we promise we won't judge. Up next, we're going to hear why South Korean activists are launching snack cakes across the North Korean border. That's coming up after the break. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Snack foods can satisfy a sweet tooth in an instant, temporarily fill an emotional void in times of distress, and even, as we've established, evoke powerful memories. They can also be a tool for pro-democratic activists. Yes, you heard me correctly, and this is why North Korea recently came down on that quintessential bit of capitalist cuisine, the choco pie. Wait, what's a choco pie?
So a choco pie is a snack cake. It's very popular in South Korea. It's basically two slices of a soft vanilla cake with a layer of marshmallow cream in the middle, and the entire thing is covered in a layer of chocolate.
Have you had one?
I have, yes. I liked them a lot as a kid growing up.
That's Monica Kim, contributing writer to Modern Farmer. Unfortunately for North Koreans who had developed a taste for the chocolatey treat, the choco pie was identified as an official threat to the DPRK and subsequently banned. Which begs the question, what kind of snack treat might be considered a symbol of communism? Regardless, South Korean activists responded the only way any self-respecting capitalist would.
Once the ban went into effect, these activists took 10,000 choco pies, put them in these balloons, and floated them across the border.
It's not easy to stop people from eating a favorite food item, especially when that item is being dropped via balloon by the thousands. But that kind of resistance hasn't stopped other governments from trying to ban food products deemed too capitalist. Bolivia's foreign minister, for example, took aim at Coca-Cola during a bizarre statement in 2012.
So as you probably know, the Mayan calendar officially came to an end at the end of 2012. And before that happened, Bolivia's foreign minister said something about how once the Mayan calendar ends, it's going to be the end of capitalism, the beginning of communitarianism. So in Bolivia, they would stop drinking Coca-Cola, this symbol of capitalism, and that they should start drinking a traditional Bolivian drink instead.
Is it like a Bolivian version of Coca-Cola?
It's called Moco Chinchi. It's a peach soft drink.
For many, battling a globally represented American brand is all but impossible. But that doesn't mean you can't mess with their menu, which is exactly what Russia did to another American icon, McDonald's.
So over the past few months, people have been discussing how Russia-American relations have hit their lowest point since the Cold War. And in late July, a Russian consumer watchdog agency brought this case forward in Moscow that the production and sales of cheeseburger royales, filet of fish, and some other McDonald's menu items should be made illegal. Their pretense was that they had done all these investigations into the health and safety of McDonald's and found that there's a lot of questionable practices going on. And so they wanted to ban McDonald's.
So the McDonald's menu took a hit for alleged health issues. But shortly thereafter, Russian President Vladimir Putin enacted a much larger ban on food imports from the United States and the European Union, leading many to believe that the burger ban had more to do with making a statement than any real beef with the beef. I'm loving it. Don't you love it too? Our final example of anti-capitalist food bans, the targeting of a certain tomato-based topping that rings of freedom and goes so well with fried potatoes.
So back in 2011, France actually enacted their own ban against ketchup, which is one of America's favorite condiments. They all believe that the American influence on the French cuisine, particularly in primary schools, was really harmful to the country's food culture.
It's kind of funny if you think about the fact that, you know, the U.S. has had stances against some foreign foods in the past, but instead of banning them, we tend to rebrand them. So I'm thinking about the early 2000s. We didn't say, we're not going to eat French fries or we're going to get French fries out of schools. We just called them freedom fries.
Definitely. And I think it's partially in that particular case because French fries are so delicious. Who would want to give them up?
Of course, you only have to look at America's biggest city and Mayor Bloomberg's long battle against sugary soft drinks to realize that banning foods, whether it's for health or ideology, is no easy task. Thanks to Monica Kim for sharing her story with us. You can check out her article for Modern Farmer, Four Delicious Foods Banned Because of Capitalism. There is a link at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, capitalist cuisine can raise ire, health concerns, or a design all of its own. This next story on the everlasting architecture of Pizza Hut comes to us from Roman Mars and 99% Invisible.
Let's start with some Pittsburgh humor. This is comedian Tom Musial on WDVE in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
It's my dad's birthday a few weeks ago, and I thought, you know what, I'm going to get something really nice for my dad, something he's really going to like. So I got him this GPS system, you know?
So the joke goes, looking to help his dad out, Tom downloaded a special plugin that makes the GPS device give directions, like a Pittsburgher.
Get on the parkway going towards town. Get off like you're going to Kennywood. Make a right, and if you go past where Swissville High School used to be, you went too far.
Where it used to be, yeah. You have to know where stuff used to be.
Sometimes the stories of what used to be can have more meaning than what's actually here now.
The philosopher Guy Debord had a word for using your emotions and memories as a way of wayfinding. He called it psychogeography.
That's the philosopher Sam Greenspan.
And psychogeography is particularly useful in Pittsburgh.
This place is just rife with things that used to be things.
This is Pittsburgh resident Mike Nielsen. Mike is not from Pittsburgh. So when he moved there, he had a hard time figuring out how to get around because Pittsburghers are always telling him to turn left at something that isn't there anymore. And so one day, Mike was hanging out with his buddy Tom.
That is Tom Musial, the comedian from a minute ago.
Tom was trying out the Pittsburgher GPS routine on Mike.
I think in one telling of the joke or somewhere along the line, he said something about, you know, oh yeah, where there used to be that Pizza Hut. The light went off in my head.
Because here, in his friend's comedy routine, was the one Pittsburghese direction he could give that anyone, regardless of where they're from, could comprehend.
Turn left at the place that used to be a Pizza Hut.
There are two hallmarks of Pizza Hut architecture. One, the windows are trapezoids.
If you see the trapezoid windows, then you know it's an old Pizza Hut.
And then there's the roof, which often has oversized trapezoidal awnings. And where they all connect at the top is this big hump that just shoots into the air. The whole thing looks like a lid for the building. In fact, the Pizza Hut School of Architecture is so distinctive that even when a Pizza Hut goes under and gets converted into a different business, you can still totally tell it used to be a Pizza Hut. And so Mike Nielsen did the only logical thing to do when you get obsessed with something. He started a blog. And his blog is called
Used to Be a Pizza Hut, which is a blog about the current uses of former Pizza Huts.
It is a global atlas of buildings that used to be Pizza Huts.
There's Soprano's Pizzeria in York, Pennsylvania, and La Porchetta in Auckland, New Zealand.
Souvlaki Hut in Dandenong, Australia.
Chinese Hut in Toronto, Ontario.
There's a funeral home in Australia that is in a former Pizza Hut.
Olsen's Funerals in Revesby, New South Wales.
There's one adult bookstore, I believe that's in Australia also.
There are even cases of Domino's Pizza in Pizza Huts.
The gall.
Mike's project points to the fact that there just aren't too many companies whose very name describes their own signature brand of mass-produced architecture that they themselves inhabit.
And now Pizza Hut's architectural legacy is one that will remind passersby of the company's failure to thrive in every single place it ever failed to thrive.
As market trends shifted away from the dining experience and on to delivery, many Pizza Huts closed. The company shifted towards a carryout and delivery model. Today, about half the Pizza Huts in the U.S. operate out of generic glass box-looking structures.
No trapezoids, no sloped roofs.
I think that if Pizza Hut phases out their signature buildings, it will be a huge mistake. Because Pizza Hut has achieved a level of greatness here. How many other structures have there ever been in history whose true essence can shine through whatever might come after it? So let us stand in awe of the mighty Pizza Hut, which, more than just about any other once beloved establishment since crumbled beneath the sands of time, can reach into the future and proclaim, just try and forget about me. Just try.
That story was brought to us by Roman Mars and 99% Invisible. Word of Mouth continues with a look at an emerging speech pattern used by younger Americans, vocal fry. We'll find out what it is and why it could be hurting women's job prospects after the news.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby in for Virginia Prescott. What do Katy Perry, Zooey Deschanel, James Franco, and pretty much all of the Kardashian clan have in common? They all tend to speak with something called a vocal fry.
I'm not staying here tonight, which is kind of like my, you know, motto.
I'm fine. I don't know. I'm a little nervous, but
it's just always nicer to do things together. Yeah.
In case you didn't catch that, vocal fry is when you lower your pitch until your words start to take on a throaty, creaking sound. Okay, I'm not really doing this properly. This is our producer, Logan Shannon. Why don't you give it a shot?
Taylor, your vocal fry needs some work.
Okay, that was perfect. Well, a new study shows that women who speak with vocal fry may actually have worse job prospects than their higher register peers. Olga Hazan, staff writer for The Atlantic, wrote about the study, and she joins us now. Hi, Olga.
Hi.
So first of all, what did these researchers do to test the effect a vocal fry might have on young job seekers?
So these researchers from the University of Miami in Duke invited seven men and seven women to say the phrase, "Thank you for considering me for this opportunity," in both a normal, in their normal voice, and then in a vocal fry type voice. And then they had 800 judges evaluate which of these voices they found to be more educated, competent, trustworthy, attractive, and appealing as a job candidate.
Okay, so I've got the vocal samples lined up right here, so we're going to take a listen. First, this is the male with no vocal fry.
Thank you for considering me for this opportunity.
Here's a male with the vocal fry reading the same sentence.
Thank you for considering me for this opportunity.
Okay, now here's a female with no vocal fry.
Thank you for considering me for this opportunity.
Okay, and finally, the female with the vocal fry.
Thank you for considering me for this opportunity.
Okay, there's something about, I mean, I even do this myself, but there's something about hearing it that way that I can sort of see why they would want to maybe test this. So what exactly did they find after people rated the different voice samples for hireability and other factors?
So perhaps unsurprisingly, they found that the normal voice was considered to be better for both the male and the female speakers.
Sure.
There was a slightly larger effect for the female speakers. So for a female who did the vocal fry, she was considered slightly less hireable than a man who did the vocal fry, if that makes sense. So it hurt the women more, basically. But specifically, the reason why they found them to be less hireable was because they were thought to be less trustworthy, among other factors. But that was sort of the most significant effect.
Less trustworthy. I would have thought maybe less professional sounding. You know, there's something that just sounds very young about the vocal fry.
Right. And so there was sort of a lot of kind of response in the linguistic community to this study that, well, you know, these people are sort of acting, so they might just kind of sound dumb or kind of like unnatural when they're you know, making these voices because this isn't their natural voice. So that could be part of it.
Now, you said that the discrepancy was rather slight, but why do researchers think vocal fry was a little more damaging to female job seekers than it was for men?
So one theory is that we sort of like it when the opposite sex speaks with the tone that is sort of average for that sex.
Uh-huh.
So for men, that would be a lower register, and for women, that would be a little bit higher. And when women do the vocal fry, it actually drops their voice lower than what would be normal for either a man or a woman. So you're already expecting them to speak a little bit higher, but here they are, you know, talking in this deep, husky voice, and it kind of messes with your perception of who they are and what they're saying a little bit, I guess. And so that could be part of this discrepancy.
Now, there's a 2011 study, which has been referenced a lot in terms of vocal fry. It found that 2/3 of college-aged women exhibit it in some fashion or another. Now, I wanted to point out that this statistic was based off a very small sample. It looks like 34 women taken from all the same school in Long Island did this survey. Nevertheless, it does seem to be a mostly young person's trend. So I'm wondering if you think there's a generational aspect to maybe our fascination with vocal fry. It seems to be really trendy right now to talk about.
Well, you know, I mean, the way we speak is influenced by social norms. I mean, you see that with accents and with, you know, things like, you know, verbal crutches like, you know, and so it could be just that cool young people started doing vocal fry. You know, you mentioned Zooey Deschanel, I think, and Kesha, and it kind of took off. And so now college students are doing it kind of among themselves. But when they're being interviewed by sort of older professionals, you know, they're maybe not hip to this sort of trend. So it's actually working against them a little bit.
Do you think the opposite might be true, too, though, that somebody might know to use vocal fry when they're speaking to their peers, but then in a professional setting might put on their, you know, professional pants or their professional voice?
Well, yeah, I mean, let's hope they do, because apparently it would not work out very well for them if they didn't do that.
Last question. There's an article in The New York Times cites some linguists as saying that young women apparently tend to be something they call linguistic innovators, and that vocal fry may sound insecure or sound untrustworthy when we're listening to it, but it may actually be a sign of confidence in young women. So do you think as time goes on, we might see less stigma attached to it and it might get appropriated by the masses?
Right. So, yeah, there is this theory that women are sort of always ahead of the curve with language, and we always start using, you know, words and exhibiting trends before the men do. And there is some evidence that men have also started to vocally fry a little bit. So it could be a sign of this happening, as sort of this like massive linguistic wave. So, yeah, before long, we could all be vocally frying and not really thinking much of it.
I love vocally frying as a verb. Olga Hazan, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Olga Hazan is a staff writer at The Atlantic. There is a wealth of articles on vocal fry and some pretty funny examples, too. We've collected them for you at wordofmouthradio.org. Did you know that you can't hunt squirrels with dynamite in Connecticut? Go figure. A look at some of the oddest laws in America when Word of Mouth continues after a break.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, sitting in for Virginia Prescott. Many of the laws we abide by are rooted in solid legal precedents and logic. Bribery is illegal, for example. You can't drive in the U.S. without a valid driver's license. The taking of goods from a store without paying is punishable by law. But some laws are just plain bizarre. For instance, this law from North Carolina.
If any person shall take and carry away, or shall aid in taking or carrying away, any ginseng growing upon the lands of another person with intent to steal the same, he shall be punished as a Class H felon.
Kevin Underhill is a lawyer in San Francisco and also author of the legal humor blog, Lowering the Bar. His new book, The Emergency Sasquatch Ordinance, is a collection of real laws, historical and modern, that all sound a little bit crazy. Kevin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
Some of the historical laws you write about earlier in the book, tell us a lot about the cultures that created them. For example, you write about the legal value of a beard in medieval Russia. And I'm wondering if you can just explain to our listeners, what was that law? And then what might it tell us about medieval Russians?
Yeah, that one was similar to a lot of other ancient laws. They would establish fines for things. In other words, instead of jail time, you would have fines, sometimes worked out between the families involved and sometimes by the state. And this one was, I thought, was unusual because the fine for shaving off somebody's beard was several times the fine for cutting off one of his fingers.
Shaving their beard against their will, I guess we should specify.
Yeah, that's what I assume. I think at the time, and still in some cultures, you know, the facial hair has religious significance. So it was, I think that was part of it, and maybe also that was a status symbol. But that's the only reason I can think of that a beard would be worth more than, you know, even one finger, let alone several.
Another one of my favorite sort of origin stories that you've got in the book was the original meaning of strip search, which apparently had a very different context for the ancient Greeks.
Yes, and that's one of the laws for which you suspect there might be a translation issue or you know, a matter of interpretation, because we just don't have the context for it. But apparently the way it worked is that, you know, instead of the police searching you to see if you stole something, this provided that if you thought someone had stolen from you, you could go over to their house and search it. But to make sure you didn't smuggle something in and plan it, you had to take off your clothes before you went into their home.
So you're
kind of the reverse.
Yeah, so you're searching, but you're naked. You're searching after you've stripped.
Yeah, basically, I think the most they could wear was a loincloth.
So let's move on. Let's get to the laws of the United States. You've got so many to talk about. One, Congress recently banned lunatics, apparently. Another interesting piece, if you lose an arm, you can legally use a switchblade. So tell us about some of these laws. How did you discover and research them all?
Well, I started out by looking at various sources that are out there. I mean, there have been books before this one on, you know, stupid laws, and then there are some websites about that too. But what you find very often is that if you go to try and look up the law, it doesn't exist.
Huh.
Because it's maybe it's an urban legend, or maybe it's just been misinterpreted to make it funny. But there is a lot of stuff out there that's real, so that's where I started. And then I sort of launched into a project of reading the codes, or at least the table of contents of all the codes. And my part of my plan was to just be able to say that I was the only person that had at least scanned the table of contents of all 50 volumes of the U.S. Code.
Right.
But by the time I got to the banking and financial regulations, I pretty much gave up on that. One thing I learned was that it's a lot more productive to go directly to the criminal code, and especially the sections on, it's usually called something like offenses against decency and morality. And you can always find stupid stuff there. In any state's laws, there will be some ridiculous provisions in there.
So some of these in your book are prohibiting people from doing something, but a lot of the others actually stipulate what you can do. For example, you write that it's legal to mail a live scorpion. So why would you need to draft a law reassuring the public that something like that is legal?
Well, in that particular one, it's really to tell people how to do it, I think.
Like how to properly mail a scorpion.
Right. You have to, you know, you have to enclose it in certain things. You know, it has to be able to breathe, but you also don't want it to get out. And so there's various restrictions. You know, people will be glad to know you can't ship them by air. But it had never struck me before that people would want to mail a live scorpion. And I guess it's for research, but you know, it's nice to know you could do it if you really needed to.
Yeah, yeah. No, I'm going to keep that in my back pocket.
It does have to be. Yeah, it does have to be clearly labeled, which I think is a good idea.
So it may come as no surprise to Californians, but you do point out that there are many, many specific laws in that state, plus a few laws in specific cities in California that have some wacky laws. We've got comic books must be less than 80% mayhem. One may not soak a rabbit carcass for more than 2.5 hours, tops. San Francisco, you can't be naked in public unless you're in a parade. I think that one kind of makes sense when you think about the context. But I'm wondering, why do you think California is so beset with these highly specific and seemingly inconsequential laws?
Well, one, it's, you know, it's a big state with a fairly long history. You know, if you look at states like, I guess, you know, Utah or Hawaii, I mean, they're not really very productive for this kind of research because they're not that old. And
right.
California is, you know, it doesn't go back to the 1700s, but it's fairly old, and it's so large that it just has a very high volume of legislation. And California has got a lot of stuff that dates back to the 1800s, and they've never cleaned it up.
Well, it looks like New Hampshire got off pretty easy. Did you find any in the Granite State worth mentioning?
Now, there I've got to look it up. Did I find any?
The appendix. I think there was one.
Right. It's a very broad prohibition on unlicensed shows and open-air meetings, and I'll just read the first part of it. It says, "No showman, tumbler, rope dancer, ventriloquist, or other person shall, for pay, exhibit any feats of agility, horsemanship, sleight of hand, rope dancing, or feats with cards or any animals, wax figures, puppets, or other show without a license from the selectmen of the town. So at one point, maybe you still do. I don't know. Do you have traveling troops of rope dancers?
I was just about to say, this explains why I've never seen a rope dancer in Concord.
But... yeah, it could be. It could be, yeah. Ventriloquists, outdoor ventriloquists.
Gosh, yeah. You know, we definitely seem to be lacking a lot of those as well.
Yeah, this law must be working then, I guess.
Yeah. So, New England in general, you mentioned Vermont and Maine both seem to escape the book. But Connecticut gets it pretty bad. We found a few from there. You can't hunt squirrels with dynamite.
Yeah, the hunting, you know, some of these are provisions that you do find in other states. And, you know, a particular one is just sort of the stand-in. And there are a number of laws where they prohibit the hunting of animals with things that you don't really associate with hunting, like this one is, you know, dynamite, you know, not chemical weapons per se, but that's basically what they're talking about. Brimstone is one of them. I'm not even sure what that means, to tell you the truth.
But hunting squirrels with brimstone?
Yeah, you can't use. I mean, brimstone is an old word for sulfur, but. I think sulfur is also listed in the law. So, I mean, I haven't been able to figure out why brimstone is in there. But if you have some, you can't use it to hunt squirrels with.
Now, I get the sense when you look at most of the laws in these books that they are just very reactionary, and that maybe that says a lot about how laws in this country and I guess in general get made. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, they get, in one sense, because they get passed, you know, in reaction to problems that exist or are just perceived to exist, and then reactionary in the sense that they don't get changed easily. And I think the reason for that is because you know, it's easy for a legislator to take credit for, you know, doing something if they pass a law, and that's what they like to take credit for that. But it's very rare that anybody gets any publicity for repealing something.
So I'd imagine that after all the examples in this book, it's probably pretty hard to surprise you when it comes to odd laws. Was there one in particular that was just really shocking or surprising to you?
You know, I guess if you had to press me, I think I would say that probably the Texas law on what you would call the marital aids. They have, and lots of states actually have laws restricting the, you know, sale or promotion of those things.
Wait, marital aids? Are we using a euphemism right now?
Yes, I am. Maybe it's I guess I was on Fox News to talk about this, and they call them sex toys. So I guess it's okay to do that on public radio.
Yeah, also. Okay. We'll let it.
We're talking about sex toys. Okay. Lots of states have these regulations on these sort of intimate things, and I'm pretty sure that they're all unconstitutional, but they are still on the books. But a couple of strange things about the laws they had in Texas was they had a limit of 5 per person. And basically, I think what was happening is they had a law against promoting them, you know, for selling them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what they were looking at were laws from the war on drugs where, you know, how do they know if you're dealing as opposed to just for personal use? It's like if you have more than a particular amount, they'll assume you're dealing. So in Texas, they decided that would be 5.
Uh-huh.
And I just can't, you know, I can't understand. Maybe that's just one of those legislative compromises that somebody wanted 10 and somebody wanted 1 and they just agreed on 5. But so I haven't been able to explain that one. And then there's also a provision that said it doesn't apply to anyone who possesses them for a variety of uses, and of course medical is one of them, but it also refers to judicial or legislative purposes. And so I'm still waiting for somebody to tell me what official legislative purposes they might have those for.
Well, we're going to leave our listeners pondering that very, very profound question. Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure. Thanks very much.
Kevin Underhill is a lawyer and the author of the legal humor blog Lowering the Bar. His new book is The Emergency Sasquatch Ordinance and Other Real Laws That Human Beings Have Actually Dreamed Up, Enacted, and Sometimes Even Enforced. You can find a link to the book and Kevin's blog at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. While California may top the list when it comes to odd laws, Alabama holds the crown for oddest constitution. With more than 300,000 words and over 800 amendments, Alabama's constitution is 40 times longer than the one signed by our forefathers in 1787 and holds the record for being the longest active constitution in the world. So, how the heck did it get that way? This story comes to us from the podcast Life of the Law.
In most places, local officials are in charge of changing zoning laws, approving new road construction, or regulating bingo games. In Alabama, you need an amendment to the state constitution, which is how Alabama ended up with the longest constitution in the world.
Brenda Ivy was living a quiet life in the hills of North Alabama until 8,000 hogs moved in across the street. Everything started to stink.
It's the worst odor that you could ever smell in your life. You put skunks. I don't even know how to describe it. You put skunks together. You put dead rats, you know, you put, what's the worst thing that you can smell? A hog.
When the farm's owners wouldn't do anything, Brenda went to the head of the county commissioner, to ask for help.
Everywhere we would go, we can't do anything, we can't do anything, we have no jurisdiction on nothing.
That's because the Alabama Constitution centers power in the state legislature. So in order to do anything, even regulate zoning for a hog farm in a tiny rural town, the county would have to pass an amendment to the state constitution. When the constitution was written in 1901, the state's economy was a mess because of debts left over from Reconstruction. To make sure that never happened again, the constitution's framers gave the legislature control over just about everything. Wayne Flint is a professor of history at Auburn University. He says most people in Alabama don't understand how much the Constitution still affects the state today.
The 1901 Constitution affects the quality of their education. It affects economic recruitment. It reflects images of the state.
In fact, he says, most of the state's problems today can be connected back to the Constitution. Take the way you need an amendment to change anything. The First Amendment lets the state build and maintain roads and bridges. Amendment 12 adds harbors. Amendment 58, airports. Then there's the amendments like 732 to let Limestone County hold bingo games, 492 to promote the catfish industry, 449 to denounce the boll weevil, which is why the Alabama Constitution has been amended 885 times, making it not just the longest state constitution, but the longest constitution in the world. It's unwieldy. But some people argue this is the way government should be.
That is representative democracy, and that's the way we've been doing it.
That's Eunice Smith. She heads Alabama Eagle Forum, a conservative advocacy group in Birmingham. Smith argues that the process allows for Alabamians to have a voice in how their state runs.
And they're deciding it by constitutional amendments. And it's not a bad thing at all.
But there are some parts that haven't been changed, even though people think they should go. The Constitution is full of racist language, which restricted voting, forbid interracial marriages, and segregated education. Federal laws have made the discriminatory parts moot. But as recently as 2012, voters decided not to change the wording in the education section because they were afraid it would increase taxes and change school funding. In fact, many people claim that taxes are what keeps Alabama from changing the Constitution. Property taxes here are among the lowest in the nation, and nobody is willing to risk changing that. Wayne Flint, the professor, thinks that mentality is slowly suffocating the state.
It's like Alabama has the intent of committing suicide. I have absolutely no hope that the Constitution will be changed in my lifetime.
Brenda Ivy has given up on getting help with the hogs. The smell finally went away for a while. But it's back. For Life of the Law, I'm Ashley Cleek.
That does it for today's show. One quick amendment of our own. If you like what you heard, there's more at wordofmouthradio.org. So check it out, pass it along, or you can also share your ideas for the program on Facebook and Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.